17, we'll call the House Special Energy Committee to order. With us today, we have Representative Tilton, Representative Tallarico, Co-Chair Vasquez, Representative Nagyak, and Representative Wool, and myself, Co-Chair Culver. Our agenda today is a review by the Alaska Industrial Development Authority on the Interior Energy Project subsequent to House Bill 105 being adopted and procurement of a gas supply for the interior region of Alaska. So if there's no other changes to the agenda, we will move forward with that. Okay, we have Representative Klayman has joined us, so we have a full committee. We'd like to invite Gene Terrio from ADA to come before the committee, and we have a PowerPoint to roll through here, and if the members want to ask a question, certainly indicate that you want to ask a question, and we can ask as we go through. Does that work for everybody? Okay, Gene, you know what to do. State your name and position for the record, please, and affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gene Terrio with ADA. I am the project lead for the Interior Energy Project. We appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee to give you an update on where things, how things have progressed since House Bill 105 was passed last year. I've got a PowerPoint slide presentation, a brief presentation. The second document that we'll go over today is a public information packet that was supplied when the ADA board met on the 3rd of March to hear a presentation and recommendation from the RFP selection committee on the source of LNG for the project. So with that, I'd just start through the PowerPoint slide. And just starting out with the IEP goals, these have been the goals for the project for the past 2 years, maybe 2 years plus that we've been working on this. It's good to always sort of take a look back to see what got you started on a particular project and see how you're doing in achieving those. And of course, some of the dynamics behind the project have changed as time has expired. So just to go back to the goals, we were looking at providing a lower cost source of clean energy into interior Alaska as the lowest cost possible to as many customers as possible in interior Alaska and as soon as possible. The IEP investments that were passed originally in Senate Bill 23 and then modified with House Bill 105 allowed us to move forward on achieving that. And at the time that we started on this project, fuel oil in the community was about $4 per gallon. It's now right at $2 per gallon, or a little bit less. So the same dynamics that have dropped the revenues to the Treasury have dropped that local fuel price. And that has affected the project a bit. But in addition to the desire to deliver a cleaner, lower-cost source of fuel, the community also has an air quality problem that's not necessarily driven by the economics of fuel oil. So going back to 2013, Senate Bill 23 was the first financing package that was put in place for the project. It offered a suite of financial tools for ADA to use to come up with a source of natural gas and then also support the build-out of a distribution system in the community to deliver the resource to the consumers. You can see the different funding sources, $125 million of loan possibility in the SETS account. And the SETS account was set up in ADA a couple of years ago by actually the legislature. It is a loan account that deals with transmission and delivery of energy to the consumer. It allows ADA to defer capital payments, lower interest rates, lean on a couple of different ways to help with the economics of the project. And so when Senate Bill 23 passed, there was an appropriation of $125 million into that account to be used as loan dollars for this project. In addition to that loan possibility, there was a $57.5 million capital appropriation included in the capital bill that year. Direct funds to ADA to be used for investment in the infrastructure with no required return from the project for utilization of those funds. And then also authorization for ADA to bond up to $150 million in addition to make funds available for the project. When the project did not move forward under that initial suite of tools and authorization, there was a bit of a reboot after looking at and receiving a proposal for delivery of supply off the North Slope. That the capital cost and gas cost, everything added up to such a degree that we were not able to meet the community's target of $15 per MCF of natural gas delivered to a residential customer, and so the project did not go forward at that time. There were suggestions that there were other sources of gas, other possibilities to meet the interior's energy needs, and so what ADA did was sort of reinitiated the project, and through the passage of House Bill 105, we were able to initiate a new RFP process that sort of threw the funnel to potential projects, that being natural gas from the north, natural gas from the south, delivered to the committee via a small diameter pipeline, the consideration of propane as the energy source. We were able to open up that RFP process wide enough to consider all of those things. That resulted in 16 different proposals coming in at the close of that RFP open process. That was narrowed down then to 5 finalists, and then from 5 down to 2, and then to the recommendation to the board on the 3rd of March was that we proceed with one finalist, that being Salix with an LNG plant in Cook Inlet, to try and paper that deal and bring a completed deal for the board to consider perhaps at their next normally scheduled meeting, which is March 31st, so the end of this month. This slide just depicts the different components of the deal. You've got not only the gas supply, and you've got to liquefy it with a plant, put it into storage, then it is loaded into a means of transportation. You can see the transportation component here. Could be truck, continuation of the trucking that currently comes out of Matsu. Potentially, there's the ability long-term to move the transportation component to Rowan. That would come with a price advantage. You deliver it into the community, you have to put it into a storage then. It's a cryogenic liquid before it is then re-vaporized and put into a gas pipe distribution system.
Yeah, Mr. Terrio, the previous slide you listed the funding sources. How much has been spent so far of $57.5 million in capital? Maybe this is a question for your Lifeline Online, your Bob Shefchek Online. He's kind of been the key advisor on this. My question is for the distribution lines installed in North Pole, how much have we spent of this funding so far?
So far, we have remaining funds of the capital appropriation of a little over $43 million. These are updated numbers that I got just last night. The major build-out of the distribution system has been achieved so far with loans out of the SETS authorization, which is set up there, and so far, none of the bonds have been accessed.
Okay, so how much have we expended out of the SETS then?
The SETS, there is a remaining ability there of a little over $72 million. So far...
A little over $50 million has been spent.
Just under $53 million.
Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question, Gene, about the... initially, you had the SB 23 mm-hmm. had all the gas coming from the North Slope. That was deemed didn't meet the $15 per CFM requirement. So then you put it out to bid, and the two finalists, one of them was back to the North Slope.
That's correct.
Is there some To the outside observer, that might seem, wait a minute, that was already deemed too expensive. So was there a major change in the way this other company was approaching it, that you would even put that as one of the final choices again?
It was a smaller plant, and just a different way of moving forward. One of the things I think we looked at, looking back to the previous attempt, there was a thought that we had gone to a finalist a little bit too soon, and the competitive nature of people sharpening their pencils and really getting, trying to get the cost down, perhaps we had lost a little bit of that ability. But when we went out for a new RFP, the finalist that made it to the two finalists, Underwear Soap was a different proposal than the original one.
Right. Okay. So thanks.
On that point, so what is Ada own on the slope? We've spent a lot of funding looking at with that pad on the North Slope where the conditioning plant would be. So what did we end up for and how much did it cost? What did you end up with as far as asset value?
The major asset on the North Slope is a gravel pad. And I believe the investment in that was about $14 million. And I will actually at this point turn to Bob Shevchuk. Bob, are you on that?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mr. Shevchuk.
Through the chair, yes, James' description is correct. The main asset is the gravel pad on the North Slope. The asset value of that pad is between $7 and $10 million, and other $4 million that has been spent was for work with it to bring the MWH project forward to the point where the board made the decision on that. And so there is an asset on the North Slope. And to the extent that project goes forward in Coquitlam, Ada would look either to lease or to sell that asset on the North Slope to go back into the project.
Okay. Follow up on that, Bob. Did we get any intellectual property designs, looking at what it was going to take to condition and treat gas as far as the engineering that had been done for this size of a project? Distribution, some of the distribution lines on the slope to go to this project, there certainly would have been done some preliminary engineering work. Do we receive that as part of the closeout of that previous proposal?
That one I can't speak directly to. I know the permitting and the layout and everything it would take to set up the plant up was in place and Ada had access to that. And we had we gone with a North Slope contractor, that same permitting and approach would have been used. Whether or not there's an added value beyond the value of the plant would depend on, somebody wanted to use it for a very similar purpose. So I wouldn't want to go so far as to say that there's incremental value to the planning for a plant on the North Slope if we put one in Cook Inlet.
What was how much did we pay that firm for that exercise in total? I mean, I guess it would include this gravel pad.
The gravel pad went to the subcontractor TIC. The amounts that were spent by Ada and paid to MWH were in the $3 to $4 million range, and that's the level to which I can tell you because I came on, I came on to pick up after that project came apart. I wouldn't run in the books on that one, but I know it was in the $3 to $4 million range, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Caldwell, I can get more specifics on that and deliver them to you also. So again, just on the different components of the supply chain, ultimately then you have the distribution in the community, certainly to deliver to commercial properties and residential. You also may have some industrial properties that would have the capability of taking LNG directly or having a transmission line serve their needs, so they really are not using the distribution line, more of just a trunked line or potential delivery of LNG directly to their property. This is just a depiction again of some of the different components that give you a little bit of an idea of now we're trying to paper the final deal with the supply out of Cook Inlet, doing the liquefaction, temporary storage, then transportation. Here we have a truck, showing a truck as transportation. Again, we continue to work with the railroad on the potential of delivering via rail, then into the community when the LNG then goes into, again, temporary storage or storage for the community, and to make sure that we honor the RCA's requirement that you have at least 5 days worth of demand, and then regassed and put into a distribution system. As you can see depicted here, there are currently two distribution utilities, the existing Fairbanks Natural Gas Utility serving about 1,100 customers in the core of Fairbanks, and then the IGU system, which is sort of forms a big horseshoe around the North Pole up over and around the existing F&G system, and the current build out of the pipe distribution system in the IGU service territory is focused out of the North Pole. At this point, we are anticipating ongoing negotiations between the two utilities to combine them into one aggregated gas utility. And looking at the capital structure that would allow us to do that, you could start to, once you have gas available to serve your customers, you could either deliver to tanks serving FNG, separate tanks serving the North Pole distribution system, or we're running the economics of linking the two existing pipe systems together via an 8-inch line that could ultimately serve as part of an expanded distribution system, so that both areas will be able to source out of the same storage tank, or linking the two together with a high-pressure transmission line. So we're running the economics of those different components, but the target is, or the desire is, that ultimately the two existing gas utilities will be combined sometime in this calendar year into one aggregated system.
Yeah, go ahead, Madam Co-Chair.
And Mr. Terrell, for the record, can you tell us what IGU stands for?
Interior Gas Utility.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
And can you also tell us what FNG stands for?
Fairbanks Natural Gas.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Continue.
How many customers are serviced by IGU?
Right now, we've put a pipe in the street, but no customers have been signed up. We can't actually sign any customers up until we can assure the RCA that we can serve their needs long term. So although we've started to put together the initial distribution system in North Pole, we have no storage there to receive gas, and receipt of that gas is contingent on finalization of the LNG plant in Cook Inlet to serve those customers.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand that the FNG distribution system right now, is it currently have a storage tank and regasification, or is it less sophisticated than the proposal for the whole area?
Well, it currently does have LNG receipt and storage.
Okay.
In South Fairbanks, the liquid is regassed and put into their distribution system.
So this would be basically either duplicating that system or somehow combining them. But anyway, you slice it, whatever's coming up for this IEP would make the current FNG service area be incorporated into it, and either through duplicative or combined tying them together.
The vision is now that under any scenario there will be receipt and storage in South Fairbanks.
Right.
In fact, there's a proposal now that we're running the economics of a 5.2 million gallon storage tank there that would be the bulk storage for the community. And so we're looking at because of the expense of storage, we're trying to minimize that and make sure that that investment is timed right so that we can move forward but not burden the initial customers needlessly with that extra cost. Ultimately, it may be that you time that expansion such that you can take some of their existing bullet tanks and move them out to North Pole so they're not having to source new, smaller tanks for the North Pole storage. So we want to move forward very carefully to really minimize that capital cost. Okay, the next slide is just starting to talk about the RFP process. And again, through the new RFP process, we basically said, come one, come all, to anyone that approached the ADA legislators, community leaders about a potential supply of energy to serve the interior needs. That initially resulted in about 16 different proposals. That was narrowed down again to 5, then to 2, and then ultimately on March 3rd, the RFP Evaluation Committee recommended to the board that team continue to move forward with one, that being Salix, with their cooking proposal. Salix is a division of Avista. Avista is the utility in the Pacific Northwest that also owns AEL&P here in Juneau. They're also looking at the economics of bringing LNG into Southeast Alaska and whether they can make the economics work in Juneau initially and then potentially communities in and around Southeast. So we're excited to be working with them. A very robust company and put together a really good proposal. So you can see we've got ongoing negotiations now with them to try and put together the terms and contractual agreements that have to be in place for us to take a completed package for board consideration. We think we still are on target to have that done for potential consideration at the March 31st board meeting. However, there's a lot of details that go into papering that deal, and we may, in fact, default to the next board meeting sometime in April. But at this point, we're trying to push forward to meet that March 31st deadline.
Yeah, Mr. Terrio, can you kind of like just give us a thumbnail sketch of some of the kind of terms and conditions of how this deal works? Like, is there a take or pay of a certain amount of gas? Do we have, how much is built into this? You know, our target's $15 delivered to the burner tip. So do we have a price, FOB, Fairbanks, and then a distribution cost on top of that? Quantities, I mean, what are some of the parameters of how this deal is proposed, if it's appropriate to discuss now that we have a final selected respondent?
Mr. Crozier, if we can actually hold that question until we get through these slides and then get to the material that was handed out of the board,
okay.
I think it might be appropriate.
Thank you.
So the other thing that is certainly in the mix is last year the ADA board made the decision to buy the current Pantex assets. That includes the existing LNG plant down in Cook Inlet and the Fairbanks Natural Gas Distribution System and the equipment that they have for trucking gas into the community at this point. ADA looks to be just a short-term owner of that. Ultimately, it may be the gas distribution utility, the combined utility in Fairbanks that purchases those assets from ADA, and then through either a long-term lease, there's a potential of the existing plant being in Natsu being operated in conjunction with the Salix plant. It's very much our desire to have that expanded capability be co-located so that the existing infrastructure and the expanded LNG capacity be able to be operated as one unit in order to keep the operating costs down. And so that ADA purchase of the Pentax assets was a key component of trying to achieve that $15 delivery target.
Gene, so what is the status as Ada as the owner, let's just say the distribution lines in Fairbanks? So that's an improvement that should be taxable just like any other improvement in an organized borough. Does Ada have a tax-free status by their ownership? In other words, none of the improvements would add to the property tax rules under Ada ownership. What is the status of an Ada-owned facility?
Yes, I believe under Ada ownership, it is exempt from taxation. And if it is combined with IGU and the IGU structure ends up being the owner of the combined utility, it would be tax exempt. But I should just double check with Mr. Shefchek to make sure that I'm giving the correct information.
Are there any follow-up on that? Are there any provisions in the legislation authorizing this project for when we get to a private sector owner of all the facilities that they would be tax exempt, or would it be treated like any other business venture taxed on the improvements at the appropriate mill rates?
I believe that if it goes into the private ownership, it would be subject to the local tax.
Okay.
And Bob, have I stated that all correctly?
If I'm still off mute, Mr. Terrio's description of the distribution system and taxation is accurate. As one looks to whether or not municipal property taxes apply, there are two things that come into effect. One is ownership and the other is control. So if you think about Mr. Terrio's description of a plant in Point McKenzie, if it is, whether it's owned by Ada or owned by IGU, if it is leased, operated, and controlled by a private entity, which would be Salix, then property taxes most likely would apply, because what they tax is the leasehold interest, even if a non-private entity owns it. So I would expect the project as envisioned now, you would see property taxes not apply to the plant in the ground in Fairbanks. Most likely they would apply to a plant in Cook Inlet if Salix moves forward with construction.
Thank you, Bob, for that clarification, Mr. Chairman. I was focused on the plant in Fairbanks, but as Bob described, there's likely to be taxes paid in that suburb.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Tullo. What was the acquisition price for acquiring Pentex, IADA?
I believe it was $55 million, but I should again turn to Bob. Is that accurate, Bob?
52.5, so you're in the ballpark.
Yeah.
Go ahead, follow up.
And how many utility customers that involve?
There's currently about 1,100 residential and industrial customers.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
So what was the cost per the 1,100 customers?
Correct.
I guess you divide 52.5 million by 1,100.
That's correct.
So
the one thing I would say, though, is the existing FNG system, distribution system, can support many more customers, and especially with the addition to the system, but it needs a larger supply of gas.
Okay. And we always have that equity issue about state investment in Cook Inlet, and we got to try to get energy around the state. Go ahead.
And then the last part of this slide just talks about the investment of in the distribution system, utilization of the SETS funds. And you can see in the last calendar year, F&G expanded their system by 30 miles. Again, their existing system had the potential of hooking up more customers, and that they've added additional miles of pipe. Again, many more customers potential once we have the supply ironed out. And in North Pole, in the last calendar year, the initial build-out of that distribution system, 73 miles of pipe. And again, the loans for those that investment of infrastructure came from SETS and prepares the community to use the expanded source now as we focus on that source being from Cook Inlet. This next slide just has the two covers of quarterly reports that have been submitted to the legislature under the terms of House Bill 105. The project is required to submit reports to the legislature on a quarterly basis. We will have another report that's due here at the end of the month. These were delivered, they should have been delivered to all of the offices electronically, and we've just put the covers up here. The full reports are available on the IEP website, and you can get to that easily through the AIDA website. And then finally, we just got a project sort of milestones here. This was the graph that was presented to the board on March 3rd, just showing how we are progressing through these different stages of the project. And again, we believe we are on track at this point to be back to the board with a fully papered deal for their consideration on March 31st. If for some reason we're not able to finalize all of that, that paper and the agreements that go along with that, we'll just slide that to the next AIDA board meeting. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that finishes the slide presentation. And so now, if it's my understanding that each of you have in your packet a set of documents that were delivered or made available to the public at the March 3rd board meeting. The cover is a memo from myself to John Springsteen, the executive director of AIDA, detailing the information packet.
Yeah, Mr. Terrio, just one question on the SETS loans. And so will those loans be repaid by the consumer base built into a rate once systems are consolidated, built out, and RCA approves a distribution rate or whatever we're going to operate under?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they are loans. We are utilizing AIDA's ability to defer payments, keep the interest rate down, so that we can get the enterprise going, but ultimately they are to be repaid. The entity is not RCA jurisdiction because it's government owned, but at this time I can tell you that with the government ownership, the existing customers, as of January 1st, there was a reduction in rates that is now kicking in. So the existing customers are already seeing some of the benefit of the project with the lowering of the current rates.
Okay, so can you kind of explain what the deferral is on the loan repayment schedule for the SETS funding? At what point is the consumer going to pick up the tab?
And for that detail, I will need to turn to Mr. Shefchik.
Through the chair, the current financing structure for both IGU and FNG loans are 1% interest rate, 30-year terms, and 5-year deferrals on payment. The ultimate package will be similar to that. The goal is to maintain pricing at that $15 target and then make payments based on the ability to pay. So we might see a change in that so that there's a more demand-based payment. So if demand comes up earlier, then more payments are made back on set than would be otherwise. But right now it's a fixed 1% 30-year with a 5-year deferral.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, the next packet then has the cover memo that just details, gives a little bit of detail of how the RFP evaluation committee, or when they met. One thing I would like to point out is in the second paragraph of the cover memo, it talks about the, also attached are redacted reports from Arcadis. And you'll see, if you look at the actual documents, that the RFP evaluation committee met on the 4th of February. The date on the Arcadis reports, though, actually are on February 26th. The reason for that is the actual Arcadis reports that the evaluation committee looked at contain some confidential information, and so we asked the two Salix from the South and Spectrum in the North what information they would like to have removed from the Arcadis report before it was made public, and that actually triggered this February 26th date. But I did want to assure you that when the evaluation committee met on the 4th, they had the Arcadis reports to take a look at. So the second bit of information in this packet is an actual report from the RFP review committee. It sort of details the issues that they took into consideration and discussed as they were evaluating the two finalists. One of the things that was very important was looking at and evaluating the annual revenue requirement for the two different proposals, knowing that no matter how many customers you were able to get hooked up, if you had this annual revenue requirement that had to be spread on whatever your customer base is, keeping that initial revenue requirement as low as possible was going to be key to getting the enterprise up and running. So that was weighed very much on the minds of the evaluation committee members. As the team members got together, they were all, after independently looking at the two finalists, reviewing the Salus or the Arcadis independent evaluations and reports. They were each able to say what they liked about the two finalists, what they didn't like, or what they were concerned with, and then have a general discussion about their different independent views. Ultimately, when they got to the end of the day, at the end of their discussions, it was a unanimous decision of that selection committee to recommend to the board that they move forward with trying to paper the final deal with Salix, with the supply out of Cook Inlet. Then you can see the next document on page 6 is sort of the outline that they had as they met that day, and they worked through this to come up with their ultimate thoughts and final recommendation. And then we get into the Arcadis reports. If you have the time to take a look at the Arcadis reports, I would point out on page 8 of this combined document, it is page 1 of the Arcadis report directed to Kirk Warren. And you can see in the second paragraph, it talks about the methodology that they put the two finalists through in their review. And I think, should you want to take the time, if you look at these two reports, they've put both of the two finalists through the same filter, and they've reported their findings with the same structure. So if you read the two, it should really walk you through sort of the head-to-head comparison of the two.
So, Ms. Terrio, it says that you gave us the write-up on the February 4th evaluation committee meeting. Was that held in executive session?
Yes, it was.
Go ahead, Madam Crusher.
Golden Valley is a utility in the Fairbanks area. What was their reason for declining to participate in this project?
At this point, they're still indicating that they would like to see, be a seasonal customer of the project, which is beneficial. We certainly would have loved to have had them as a larger anchor tenant, but with the drop in the price of oil, the Petrostar refinery was able to offer them a fuel source that undercut the suggested delivered price and offer it to them sooner than what we were going to be able to deliver. So we understand that, you know, that's the competitive nature of the energy prices. Whether oil stays down such that they stay as just a seasonal user of the LNG, or eventually come on as a large tenant customer, anchor customer. We will continue to have negotiations with them. At this point, their seasonal demand actually does help in the summertime when their heating load really drops away. The use of the LNG to spin the turbine out North Pole that lends itself to fuel switching does help to make sure that you still have cash flow even in the summer when that heat load really drops off significantly.
I think it would be helpful if Ms. Terrio, if you or Mr. Shefchek kind of went through the 6-page Arcadis reasonableness review of the Salix proposal. Maybe just kind of like tell us what page you're on and the issues, the analysis and the summary of that so that we can kind of get a little bit more understanding of what the proposal entails?
Sure. I think the best way is if I just sort of walk quickly through and point out key bits of information. Again, on the page one of the document directed to Mr. Warren, it talks about the methodology that they used in the second paragraph. As you move over to page two of this particular letter, you get into the evaluation then of Salix. It talks about them being a subsidiary of Avista. It evaluates the financial strength of Salix and its parent company. It gets into a technical project description then of Salix's actual proposal to the RFP, and then discusses the suggested gas supply that will feed the infrastructure. Then you get into the discussion there of the gas treatment, the LNG liquefaction plant, and their proposal for storage, the on-site storage, giving you some of the metrics with regard to costing of those components. On the next page, at page 10 of the combined document, it talks about the power to operate the LNG plant, whether they're going to source power from the electric grid or be self-generation.
Yes. Page 2, gas supply. This is kind of a key thing it says. Final, after there's a colon in the last sentence, says, the natural gas received for liquefaction will be purchased by utilities participating in the IEP. So the Fairbanks utilities are responsible for buying the gas supply, not Salix. Salix is a liquefaction utility and transportation.
Yes, it would be up to the utilities to actually sign those gas supply contracts on behalf of their customers. They then are taking that gas to the Salix plant, and the plant is operating under a tolling agreement, basically, to liquefy that on behalf of the utilities.
How do we get cost containment then, what the project is envisioned, the $15, if we don't have negotiated contracts and Salix doesn't have the burden of procuring those contracts and delivering that gas at the prescribed price?
Right. Showing that there is a supply for that gas at a price and duration of the contract that meets the project goals is one of the requirements of House Bill 105, that the ADA board needs to see all of those components before it moves forward with an actual project.
Okay, so Salix is not involved in any production, not buying any assets in Cook Inlet or developing any gas resources. They're simply operating as a utility, and it's up to the interior utilities or the conglomerate of those two utilities to secure gas supply?
That's correct. And at this point, ADA has helped with identifying potential sources of gas and started initial discussions to see if, in fact, it appeared that we could get the gas at a price and a quantity and duration that would allow the project to move forward. Ultimately, though, those negotiations would be handed off to the utilities for them to close that deal. They would be signing the gas contracts to supply their customer base.
So you're referring to the RFP that ADA put out trying to secure a gas supply for this project in Cook Inlet?
The RFP was really for the liquefaction.
Okay, but wasn't there a proposal out or a request for gas supply contract, seeing what the market is, what the opportunities were to supply this project? Didn't ADA put something out in referring to that in the previous months?
We put out a request for information.
RFI.
Right. And so over time, especially now as we appear, we've selected the Cook Inlet, there's been increased interest in people coming to the team saying that they have a supply of gas that they would like to be considered. And at this point, we've got a couple of potential suppliers in play, and ultimately the utilities will be the ones that will sign the contracts for that supply.
And to follow up on that, wasn't one of the finalists a supplier or owner of leases in Cook Inlet? was part and parcel of their proposal was to provide the gas to the project as well.
I think Mr. Shep should step in.
Bob, if you could comment on this supply angle, because I see that as one of the variables that we can't necessarily nail down as far as hitting that target delivered price without having some kind of a contractual agreement within this proposal. If it's just going to be passing... Oh, he's offline? Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I think I can help with that. And actually, we'll be getting to a portion of this report here that talks about how we evaluated these proposals for the liquefaction. You had to have an idea of the cost of gas going in. We used a $6 per MCF price for our evaluation. We think that number, there's a potential of that number being even improved as we move forward with the negotiations and then the utilities ultimately sign those contracts. That's just a couple of pages further into this.
Call that a plug number?
That was a plug number, exactly.
Dave, Representative Calrico.
Thank you. And Senator Terrio, thanks for being here today. Is the model that I see right that it would actually be contracting with the producers and the potential tariff rate in the NSTAR line, would that be a direct purchase from producers, so it could be a utility producer contract potentially for a long term? I would assume.
Well, I guess it runs the gamut of it could be just from a producer. Of course, then you have to get the gas to the plant. That's through the NSTAR system. There will be a tariff that will go along with it. NSTAR is also the owner of gas. They could propose to actually sell the gas that they have, and that would include that transportation component. So all of that is in the mix in the negotiations with the potential gas supply.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Shevchek, we were just having a conversation about the conditions under page 2 of 6 of the Arcadis analysis, gas supply, and the committee is just kind of drilling into the fact that the project proposal doesn't include a supply contract and that the utilities would be purchasing. How did the RFI, request for information on gas supply, how did that measure up to the $6 MCF plug number that you use for the delivery price to the interior?
We have a team who is still negotiating with multiple suppliers, and haven't to talk much about it, but we believe we're still in the range in order to make the project go forward. The pressure, if gas supply comes in above 6, then you have to find ways to bring transportation or liquefaction costs down. But we believe we're in the range at this point and are still negotiating. I did get cut off right as you sir, I believe, were asking the question about were there any proposers who provided bundled gas and liquefaction, and out of the 17 proposals, there were 2 who bundled both gas and liquefaction, and the other 15 had some other mix, but it was mostly tolling services or transport services, not bundled gas. And so in the casting of the broad net, we did have a mix of choices.
Okay, Bob, thank you for that. On the follow-up on that, so how long typically are these supply contracts? What's the vision in this project as far as we're tied to any Henry Hub? We've got a fixed price with escalators. What kind of terms are we looking at for these gas supply contracts to deliver this gas at a competitive rate in Fairbanks?
Well, we are looking at one duration, probably longer than you're used to seeing. Usually you see 3 and 5 year contracts out of Cook Inlet in order to to balance the investment. If it's not a 10-year contract, we're looking at 5 with an extension so that we have a surety of a supply into the distance. And we've discussed both fixed with escalators and tied not to Henry Hub, but if you see on the North Slope, tied the price of oil, we tend to avoid those, but the economics tell you that if the price of oil goes up, the ability to pay more for your gas and the differential also increases. So we haven't, we've totally rejected those, although they're not the way that we are looking to proceed. I guess it's as far as I would really want to discuss terms in public.
Okay, thank you.
And so, Mr. Chairman, then on page 10 of the combined document, we get to the evaluation of the power to run the liquefaction plant, the balance of plant design and CapEx, detailed project costs in there on the bottom of page 10. 11, the Arcadis goes over the commercial terms and project financing, how we use the financing tools affects the cost of the LNG out of the plant, risk identification and allocation, and then ultimately, then on page 12, we start to get into the details and the ability to meet the IEP goals, and that is that $15 per MCF of gas delivered to a residential customer. So that would include the transportation, the storage, the regas, put it into the distribution system, and deliver it to the outside meter on a residential dwelling. You can see under detailed ability to meet the IEP goals, Arcadis evaluated the Salix proposal as it stood at that time to be able to deliver to that residential customer of $15.74. So we're close to that community target of $15. The community target of $15 per MCF of gas is comparable to $2 fuel oil. And right now, if you're getting fuel oil delivered in Fairbanks, you might be right at $2 or just a little bit under. So even with the very low price for crude oil and the resulting fuel oil that it produces, we think we're neck and neck with the delivered commodity to a residential customer, even when we put together all of those price components. You can see within that that paragraph, you've got this the Salix liquefaction fee of $3.24. You've got the plug number for the gas going in the plant of $6.
Where are you at on that?
That's on the page 12 of the combined documents, under detail on the ability to meet the IEP project goals. It's about in the middle of the page there.
Yeah, go ahead, Madam Kutcher.
Mr. Terrell, for the record, you've got two acronyms, CAPEX. Is that an acronym or actually the name?
No, that's CAPEX, so that's your capital cost that goes in, and then the OPEX is your operational costs.
Thank you.
Liquification.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The plug number of $6 per MCF for the supply gas, is all this additive? So for example, that was lowered to $5. The price at the burner tip would then be $14.74?
That's correct.
Okay. Thanks.
And you can see in this paragraph, about the middle of the paragraph, Arcadis goes over, points out, however, current market conditions for cooking at gas supply suggest that there is a downward potential for pricing of this feed gas. So we're hopeful that we're able to bring that cost component down, whether it's a dollar or not, is unsure. Whatever you save on the gas price going into the plant, because the plant is going to self-generate the energy, that also lowers the operational cost too. So certainly any cost that we can squeeze out there, we get benefit, not only directly of the molecule that you deliver to the customer, but also you're burning that energy source to power the plant too, and you get savings there.
So to further answer your other question, if the gas were to go from $6 per MCF to $5 per MCF,
you'd not only save a dollar at the burner tip, you'd also save in your liquefaction fee of $3.24. So it would be beyond additive. There would be a multiplier downward. So it might be, instead of $14.74, it might be $14.25 or something like that. Okay.
In addition, we're hopeful that we'll be able to get transportation costs down. The railroad, I'm told by the team that's working with the railroad that they are really thinking outside of the box to see how that they could actually deliver the commodity to the community sooner rather than later. The one problem is that initially the demand starts up pretty low, and the railroad lends itself to really bulk commodity delivery. But that's not to say that they're not trying to figure out how they can pick up some of that business, and we're happy for that because that would reduce the delivery cost to the community.
So on that point, is there a rail siding at the current storage location for FNG?
I don't believe the rail goes right up to the existing facility.
Actually, the rail up, excuse me, this is Bob Shepard, Chair. The rail up to the site, there is not a siding built, but siding would be required to build, but there is rail access to the current site. Okay, so if we were to use existing configuration, existing plant, we would have to have ISO containers that would be truck, basically van size, and then put on flat cars to move up on the rail?
Exactly.
Okay. Can you speak, Bob, to kind of the broad brush of the other proposals? We're talking a lot about the plug number here. How difficult was it for the other proposals to meet this price point, and then what were some of those difficulties when you looked at comparison North Slope versus Canadian Gas and other options, and how does the Cook Inlet one rise to the top, I guess, if you could summarize?
Yes, sir. I feel most comfortable speaking to the range of the five finalists because they each released public summaries of their proposals as part of the process. We had two from the North Slope and three from Cook Inlet out of the five finalists. The challenges you found on the North Slope were capital expense and high fixed operating costs. And so what you found as in low demand scenarios, those early years led to pretty significant negative cash flows. And the vendors were creative in ways to try and mitigate that and to smooth costs across time. But in 3,000 foot level, what you had was higher fixed costs and higher capital expenses with significantly higher trucking costs and risk tied to lower gas. Cook Inlet, there was a mix of we have gas and we'll do bundles for you, or we would import. We had one that was looking at seriously importing and one that was towing only. And in all of those, the challenge was where's the most effective use of your money long term? And one of the bundle proposals consistently had difficulty finding a way to come to the target range of the pricing. The imported gas, there were a lot of risks on it required plants that weren't built yet, docking facilities that weren't built yet, and sinking your capital into transport vessels rather than in infrastructure in the state. And so really when it came down to how did they win over the top, the towing plant that was more certain with a utility backed parent rose to the top, and then the one North Slope project that had a proposer that has built plants before rose to the top on that side. And you have the memo from the evaluation committee, and so my input I would tell you the best input on what the committee was thinking is in that. I would tell you from my perspective, when you did the financing on a plant on the North Slope in a low fuel oil price environment, the risks of a North Slope plant were significant relative to that first 5 years of low cash flow. Could you make the project survive? And so that balance with more surety and cost of transport and construction on the Cook Inlet side really led the committee toward what's the best choice for the current economic environment decision. I would say that's a fair characterization.
Madam Co-Chair.
I have a 40,000 foot question, and it concerns efficiencies. There are three major players and consumers of energy in that area, the Fairbanks area. It is Golden Valley Electrical Association. It is the University of Alaska at Fairbanks and the military base. Was there any type of thought, action, study to see if there was an ability to have any joint action in order to bring down the cost of this whole project in working with one of these three identities?
Through the chair, the answer is yes to that. There was considerable work, as Golden Valley was one of the leads on the 2014 effort for this project that didn't go forward. And as Mr. Terrio mentioned earlier, Golden Valley was offered an opportunity by PetroStar, and so they weighed heavily, could they be a year-round anchor tenant, or were they better off sticking with oil and having a dual fuel capacity by being a summer customer? And they picked the summer customer, and that, more than just affecting demand, affected that solid monthly demand and made a North Slope plant more challenging. The university we looked at, and I do have to confess, ma'am, I worked at the university for a number of years, and so I understand that project fairly well, has been moving forward across time, and at UAF, the decision was deferred for a year or two to see if gas was going to come together, and in 2012 and 13, the decision was made to go forward with a solid fuel plant that could switch to gas, but not at pricing in the $10 to $12 range that bulk pricing would come to town. Out of the military bases, right now there's still two options, one being on Fort Wainwright. They do have infrastructure issues relative particularly to North Post, and whether or not gas in their hangars on North Slope would be a better solution to their infrastructure issues is still being discussed. The F-35s and the Belmont and Eielson is a possibility, but Eielson recently spent money renovating all three of their boiler systems for their solid fuel coal. So I would say out of them, Fort Wainwright is the most likely. And given that scenario, the shrinking of the plant from 9B to 6B, now down to 3B to meet Golden Valley summer load, and the load known next to the existing pipe, it is the approach that both economically and prudently one is taking, rather than overbuilding in the current environment so that you can capture these opportunities. And so as Fort Wainwright comes open, they'll be interested in gas, and we'll be looking at a gas supply that pencils off of their demand, but not in advance like we were, say, in 2012 and 13 when the price of oil was $100.
Mr. Chairman.
If that was more than you asked, I apologize.
No, it's never more than I asked. Thank you very much.
And then, Mr. Chairman, the final part of the Salix report on page 12, under overall reasonableness and completeness of the development plan, this is where the Arcadis
took the proposals from Spectrum and Salix and basically compared them to what they see worldwide as far as cost per volume of LNG. You can see down at the bottom of page 12, they evaluated the Salix proposal to be 105% of what they see as the mean worldwide for the construction of LNG plants. So they basically said, they thought that Salix was pretty much on target with what they're seeing around the world. They did say that it had a plus or minus 30% possibility in the capital costs. But then when it came to Spectrum, they basically said it's got a plus or minus 30% on the capital cost, but they evaluated Spectrum's reasonableness of their proposal to be at 48% of what they see worldwide. And so that suggested that the potential for capital overruns was higher with the Spectrum plant than it was with Salix. And so if you're very focused on keeping managing that capital cost, I believe that that was a concern of the evaluation committee. And then the last part of the document here is the Arcadis report with the same structure that I just walked you through for Salix. So you can do a project-to-project comparison. And then the final page is that project milestones document again. So with that, that brings you up to speed with where you come, sort of the history on the project, the most recent publicly disclosed documentation as the selection committee narrows the field down and tries to move forward with papering the final deal to take to the board for consideration. Before we're done, I just wanted to focus a little bit on the customer side of the meter. We know that although
Representative Coleman. Just one question before you go too far past. You were looking at the overall reasonableness and completeness of the development plan. And I followed that part about comparing Salix and the other proposal and where they fit in the world market, but I'm more interested in this plus or minus 30% figure is for a project that I know is clearly not happening next week by any stretch of the imagination, but is this plus or minus 30%, is that kind of normal in this industry? That my first reaction to plus or minus 30% is if it's plus 30%, this suddenly starts looking a whole lot less economical, and if it's minus 30%, it's looking pretty good. But that's a pretty broad range, because once you, so can you tell me a little bit more about how that fits in
certainly
the picture?
Mr. Chairman, I think that where we are right now with the expected level of project engineering and design, plus or minus 30% is reasonable. As we now move to finalize the deal and move into detailed engineering, that's when you would squeeze that down before you actually pull the trigger to move forward. You would want to narrow that band of uncertainty down much further to 10% or less, I would expect.
And follow up. So what you're saying is at this stage of a project like that, 30 plus or minus 30% you would view as fairly normal.
Yes, that would be fairly normal. And one thing that, because everybody knows the community target price and the fact that the competing fuel has come down so that it's pretty much on parity with that delivered price, anybody involved in this project knows that if costs run away, there's not going to be a project. If you're wishing to sell gas to this project, if price goes away on your supply, you're not going to sell any gas. So I think everybody really is motivated because there is that target, and it's not just a target that was arbitrarily set by the community. Now it is at parity with the competing fuel. And so everybody has to keep focus on that. Otherwise, in fact, you won't have customers sign up to take the commodity. So just on the...
This is really interesting to me when here I'm looking at page 12 and you make reference to 105% of the worldwide ratio. Why a worldwide ratio versus a nationwide ration. In other words, I can envision projects in the middle of the jungle of Brazil or Africa for that matter, and with no infrastructure at all, and obvious lack of sophisticated whatever, know-how, labor. I'm just wondering why worldwide ratio, instead of looking at it, comparing it to those projects within the United States, which would make more sense to me.
Right, I think, and Bob can chime in here too, but I think it is that in some regions of Alaska, if you're building a project, it is more comparable to trying to build something in the middle of a jungle. There is limited infrastructure, and certainly there are many locations in the lower 48th where capital costs or construction costs are much lower than they are even in Cook Inlet. And so we didn't want to restrict that review and basically be looking at sort of the most favorable location to build infrastructure of this type, because we know Alaska, no matter where you go, it's not the most favorable. Our projects just come with higher costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see, Gene, you talked about the price of $15 per MCF is sort of the target price, which is equivalent to $2 heating oil. In a couple of years ago, that was $4, which has gone down to $2. What is the price of Cook Inlet gas done in that time? If you're using $6 as your sort of plug number, as we're calling it, what was that number a few years ago? And has it hasn't paralleled the $4 to $2 drop, I'm imagining, right?
And actually, your co-chair might know more about that, having been involved in gas purchasing from utilities, but gas off the Instar system, I think, went up to, was it $8 or $9 per MCF? And now it's starting to drop back down. That's when there was the thought that the cooking rate was, you know, on the decline. Of course, that has turned around now, and you actually have supply, and we're reading headlines about utilities locking in supply at decreasing prices. And so that, I think, is what is referenced here in the paragraph about the current market conditions suggests that even the $6, we might be able to improve on that if we're locking into a quantity for a longer period of time that somebody's looking to finance a part of their project with. That surety, is meaningful to them, and so they might be willing to give us a slightly better price.
Okay. And the only other question was a remark that Bob Shevchek made, which was the university and possibly Fort Wainwright being a gas customer, and he said the university project at even $12 or $10 doesn't price out for natural gas, so they're going to stick with solid fuel. Is there a solid fuel? What is the, I mean, if $15 is $2 diesel, what is it, what is the current coal price in natural gas, or is it just like $2 per MCF? Is it something just...
And Bob, when I worked at Golden Valley, I had sort of in my mind that the price for 1 million BTUs of heat off of coal was right, like $5 now. That was a number of years ago, but it's significantly lower
right,
than the natural gas price that we can deliver to the government.
To compete with a solid fuel or coal in a natural gas world, it would have to be a totally different supply and obviously more like a big gas line.
And especially since the university and the military bases, they generate electricity and use then the waste heat for the heating of the facility, so it's a cogeneration, so they get maximum use of those BTUs.
Okay, so your final slide you had, final, the board action was June 23, the board will make a final investment decision to move forward with executing contracts.
That is the target that at the March 31st meeting that we would show them the paper deal. They would be able to see the different components, but realizing that there are still a lot of details to really get distilled down into final contracts. And so we think we're on track to meet this schedule, but it could slip by a few weeks.
What's the schedule on commencing construction and keeping this timeline with final investment decision end of June? When would they get in? Once they get a contract, I suppose they get into design. When would we look at the infrastructure starting to be built?
I think you would see surface work being done certainly this summer and fall in preparation of the plant components being constructed. Some long lead time items would take 12 months, 12 plus months, and then the actual importation of the components and putting them on site, not in this construction season, but the next year. The thought is that there would be the potential for first gas out of the plant sometime in late 2017, perhaps. We wouldn't expect that a lot of residential customers would be changing out their heat plants in the middle of winter. So really, for a residential customer, you're looking at supplying them probably in spring of 2018. There could be some industrial users that maybe would be willing to convert sooner than that. The utility certainly would be interested in hooking up customers as soon as possible.
Okay. Madam Kocher?
Yeah, and I apologize, Senator Farrell, I said Mr. But earlier, consumers need to, this dovetails to the question I had, consumers need to convert to gas. What is the estimated price for a residence to convert to gas?
Yeah, for a residential setting, it depends on the age of your existing boiler and the type of equipment that you have. If your boiler is less than 10 years old, it may lend itself to a conversion change out of the gun, which we're told is $2,000 to maybe $3,000. IGE actually had people volunteer to have somebody come and evaluate their system. I think they got 50 or 60 people that volunteered for that. And I was quite surprised at the high percentage of those residential settings that the evaluation showed that they could convert at that lower cost. Now, that means that you're going to get the energy efficiency of your existing boiler. Right. If you switch to a new gas-fired appliance, you're not going to be able to utilize the gas, clean the burning fuel, but also jump your efficiency up. But that is going to cost you a complete swap-out, which is going to be $10,000 to $12,000. So we know that expense on the customer side of the meter is meaningful, especially if we're delivering commodity to the outside wall that's on parity with fuel oil. And so that, Mr. Chairman, brings me to the last bit of information that I want to touch on, is we are looking at mechanisms that can help the customer with that conversion in being able to access loan funds that have a lower interest rate, spread the payments out over time so the consumer can afford to do so, and hopefully still see a drop in their energy cost because they're able to spread those costs out over time. We have identified a couple of sources of federal funds that come with reduced interest rates, or one that even potentially comes with a zero interest rate to the borrowing entity. That entity then would be able to loan those monies out to the consumer and add on an interest rate, but hopefully be able to keep those costs down and spread the payments out over a longer period of time. So we're not just focused on the infrastructure to deliver to the community and give it to the outside wall. We're also focusing on assistance that we can give the individual consumer then to make economic decisions for their business and their residence on how they can convert to this cleaner source of fuel.
Okay. Any other further questions by the committee? Well, thank you, Senator Terrio, for giving us this useful information. Good luck. We look forward to gas at the burner tip in Fairbanks. So at 11:36, committee is adjourned.